Greetings, and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Lori Mayer. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Joe. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the IOMSN as co-chair for this program tonight, I'd like to welcome you to Town Hall Discussions. Tonight's program is entitled Motivational Interviewing for the MS Nurse. These educational sessions are held by telephone on the third Tuesday of each month, and each discussion is led by an IOMSN member speaking on a selected topic for about 15 minutes. Which then will be followed by open discussion, limited to 1 hour. We would like to acknowledge and show our appreciation to Biogen IDEC for supporting the project through an unrestricted educational grant. Thank you, Biogen IDEC. So let's begin tonight. For our town hall discussion, I would like to introduce you to Dottie Cassidy Pohl. Dottie is a clinical coordinator of the Comprehensive MS Center of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Dottie has been involved in nursing and research for over 42 years, and she began her specialization in MS nursing in 1989. She is one of our original founding board members of the IOMSN, and she continues to be very actively involved with IOMSN, the CMSC, the National MS Society, the MS Association of America, and the MS Foundation. She also serves on two editorial boards. One is the International Journal of MS Care, which is the official publication of the IOMSN, and the other is the MS In Focus, which I believe is the newsletter for the MS Foundation. This last year, she was a recipient of the June Helper Award for Excellence in MS Nursing, and this she was presented at the CMSC, and Dottie actually delivered one of the most eloquent acceptance speeches that I have ever heard presented. Dottie, please join me in welcoming Dottie for this evening's meeting. Dottie, I'm turning it over to you.
Oh, wow. I think only my mother would have said nice. Thank you, Lori. I would clarify, though, that the one of the editorial boards that I'm on is the MS In Focus, which is the international journal for the International MS Society. So anyway, for what it's worth, I wouldn't want my buddies around the world to say, oh, well, she didn't mention us. But it's a pleasure to be with you tonight and have a chance to visit with friends and IOMSN members from around the country. I am in Philadelphia, where we are having miserable rain and horrible weather all up and down the Northeast anyway. So hopefully where you are, you're comfortable and dry. My topic for tonight is motivational interviewing. And when I was first approached about the topic, I thought that's interesting because a year or so ago, June Helper actually gave me an article on motivational interviewing. And it was Motivational Interviewing, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And I thought, what is this all about? And then in looking into it, I thought, okay, well, that's sort of what the name implies. But subsequently, my colleagues, Colleen Harris in Calgary and Linda Moore in Charlotte, North Carolina, shared with me some of their input and work that they've done on presentations on motivational interviewing. So it's a topic that I hope you will find interesting and indeed a skill many MS nurses have, and certainly we can all develop. In preparing for this talk, I was able to gather some tidbits, and was sort of funny because I heard Dr. Oz, of all people, on TV, and he was talking about the globalization of medicine and this human journey to health just at the time as I was trying to absorb this article on motivational interviewing, and talking about things like cultural consciousness and coming to grips with what an illness means, to the person, to the patient, and I might add to the family, is something that whether we work in MS centers or in acute care or in the home, for industry, just really almost any setting that nurses would be practicing in, I think that we can identify with that coming to grips with what the illness means as a springboard then for what I think we'll find motivational interviewing will entail. Because as nurses, I think we form covenants with the patients. And in forming a covenant, we work toward what will be right for the patient. And this Dr. Oz, again, spoke of intuition, how we all have this intuition and move from being like doctor to teacher or medicine man to healer and then healer to scientist. And these days of evidence-based medicine, I think we are all looking for some data, some hard science to back up what we do as an art. I like to think of the nurse as expert messenger, because very often we are the ones that bring the message of the illness or of what facing perhaps chronic illness might be to the patient, but not just as the bearer of news or information, but as an expert. And we do influence what we do not necessarily control. And I think that's one of the skills and one of the talents and one of the gifts that we bring to what we do. So motivational interviewing actually is like a refined form of guidance, of guiding. So this article that I've mentioned, Motivational Interviewing, was published in the British Journal of General Practice and by Sune Rubak, who was a research fellow at the time. And he defines motivational interviewing as a scientifically tested method of counseling clients. And it was developed by Miller and Rollins, and we will provide you with a nice list of references if you're interested in getting into the topic. But it's viewed as a useful interventional strategy encouraging the treatment of lifestyle problems. So lifestyle problems, disease, a way of influencing behaviors. So who needs MI? Every time I say MI, I fluster a little bit because we all know it's not myocardial infarction that we're talking about, but motivational interviewing. And we need behavior change to manage health risks, everything from smoking or non-adherence to treatment regimens. But the challenge to us as healthcare providers is to create an environment that motivates the patient to embrace change. So it's coming really from the patient, maybe through us, but from the patient. And the theory is a model really of behavior change. And any of us who've tried to change our own behaviors know how hard that is, much less trying to influence others to change. So I have to throw in a little bit of theory. Wouldn't be appropriate not to. And for that, I go to the trans-theoretical model. You can look at Pat Kennedy's article on patient expectations of therapy in the Journal of MS Care. That would be the winter of 2005-2006. But this trans-theoretical model of behavior change talks about stages of change. Change isn't necessarily the result of one single decision, but rather a course of changes, everything from emotional readiness, and we all know when we want to change, but we're just not emotionally ready to do that. And that emotional readiness might move through acknowledging a need for change, contemplating and preparing for change, and then making the changes, taking action, and then importantly, maintaining that action after we've made a change. So there are multiple ways to get there. I know for myself, I often use the expression taking two steps forward and one step back. So it's not always one and done, but really a trajectory. Unfortunately, sometimes I've been known to take one step forward and then two steps back. So it can be a very fluid kind of an affair. In Holland's work on adherence to disease-modifying therapy, the patient can see the benefit. Then they feel they can do it. So it's conveying some of that to folks, that not only, hey, look, let's take a look at what we can do. So the patient's activating the patient's own motivation for change can be the first step. I believe motivational interviewing was first developed as a brief intervention for problem drinkers, but now, as we know, it's used in a variety of settings. The way in which we even talk to a patient about their health can substantially influence their personal motivation for change. I got that from Linda Moore. I thank her for that. But we have all seen that sometimes, you're just on and what you say clicks and you can see that. There's just something in human nature that resists being coerced and told what to do. I like to say in my family we suffer from something called the jackass syndrome. If you push us, we sit down. And ironically, it's just acknowledging the person's right and freedom not to change. You don't have to do this. That sometimes makes that change possible. I mean, it just seems counterintuitive, but it's not. So following something I would call the rules, actually, Linda and Colleen shared this with me, for effective self-management, guiding principles for motivational interviewing would include resisting the writing influence, understanding motivations, listening, and empowering. So the RULE, resisting the writing influence, understanding motivations, listening to the patient, and empowering the patient. One of the things that I value most about what I do is that I have what I call the luxury of relationships, that I have patients, some of them have been in a study with me since 1991. I see them every 3 months. I mean, I don't see my relatives as often as I see some of these folks. So, really, when we have that kind of luxury, that kind of intimacy with our patients, we can work toward educational interventions and be a positive, supportive presence for patients. But even if the only encounter we have is a short term, maybe an hour on the telephone, maybe not even that, maybe one encounter, one and done, we can still be that positive, sustaining presence for our patients, teaching patients to manage illness as best they can by individualizing programs and offering ongoing support over time, sometimes even if that ongoing support is just a referral to other supportive agencies, et cetera. So again, resisting the writing influence reflex, what is that? We all have a tendency to want to fix things, to make things right, to tell people. But the next step is for the rules would be to understand the person's motivations. I love it when I talk with folks and listening to the patient. But when I get what I call the bobblehead response, that we're talking and then all of a sudden their head starts bobbing, I know that they're hearing me, or vice versa. I will do that too. And the goal then is to empower the patient, to empower the person to make those changes. So I don't want to overdo and belabor that, but sometimes understanding the patient's own reasons can help trigger behavior change, guiding them helping you understand to helping them understand theirs. You have to understand your own values and motivations to try to get into someone else's head and understand theirs. But by asking things like, why would you change and how would you go about doing it, they may come up with ideas and creative ideas that are better than the ones that you could. So that it's the person, the patient, who should voice the arguments for behavior change, not the practitioner. And I do this when I'm doing injection training. If someone comes to me and says, no way am I going to do that, you're going to have to talk me into it. I'll say, no. You're going to have to convince me that this is what you want to do. Because if it comes from them, then I know that we're going to go forward. Good listening is such a complex clinical skill. Empathetic interest is certainly necessary. And being sure you convey that, hey, I get it. Effective listening, when it's used, then it's going to make behavioral change more likely. And we in MS nursing love the term of empowering our patients, because the outcomes are simply better when the patient takes an active interest in their own health. So sometimes the person in the consultation thinking aloud about how and why to change, they're more likely to do it. And I love the negative effect, too. Sometimes what motivates a person is just entirely different from what you think. As a young nurse, I smoked. I think we all took up smoking in nursing school. But in trying to quit, I tried all the little tricks, all the ideas, all the things I could to get myself to quit. And then one day a beautiful, beautiful young woman came in for an interview. She wasn't just pretty, she was gorgeous. And she smelled like a cigarette ashtray. And I thought, ooh, I don't want to smell like that. And I was able to quit. So sometimes it's something very remote that can really help. So there are styles for communication that I think are important, and those include guiding, directing, and following. And we all do that, sometimes instinctively, but in the course of conversation, we might use all three of those styles. Following, where we listen, we see through the patient's eyes, and convey the sense of not pushing, but trusting your wisdom about yourself, and giving opportunity to give information and seek answers. Directing, though, you take charge. That's where it's more of an uneven relationship regarding knowledge. Sometimes you have to do that to save a life. People depend on you for this style in certain situations, but then also I know you can solve the problem, and I know what you should do, so I'm going to give you some information about that. Guiding is one of the things that I think we fall back to quite often, because in human relationships, you can influence what you don't personally control. So it's well suited to helping people solve behavioral change problems. And motivational interviewing is a refined form of this guiding style, because often the practitioner has specific behavior change in mind and can gently guide the person to consider why they might want to pursue these goals. So we can talk a little bit more about the communication skills, like asking and being directing, like how many times has this happened, or what kind of change makes sense to you, or how have you been since a certain influence, where you're directing, how many times, you're guiding, does this make sense, and then how many times where you're asking specific questions. So good listening, it means that you have to check on the person's comprehension. What you're saying is important to me. I want to hear more. So you reflect back. You use directing and saying, okay, so now you understand what this medicine can do for you. You want to learn more about the long-term effects, so it's being directive. Or, okay, I hear you're concerned about putting on weight, but you're unsure where to go from here. So that's where then we would be guiding. Or, I know this has come as a big shock. Getting accustomed to a diagnosis can be a huge shock. So then you follow and listen for the person's response. Another thing that we do is informing, conveying knowledge about the condition or the treatment. So we may do a directive form like, your best option is to take these, blah, blah, blah. Or to guide, it would make sense medically to change your diet. How does that feel to you? Or in following, yes, that's a common experience. Many people feel shocked when they're first diagnosed, especially to be so young to have to think about a chronic illness or whatever. So in health settings, the shifting of communication styles, as I said, takes place a number of times within a consultation, and this is just a matter of good practice. We do it every day. Another thing that I think is really important in motivational interviewing is listening for change talk. You know, we all know that wonderful, makes good sense, honey, but, and then that big but comes in the middle and signals to us that the person is ambivalent. Like, I may need to lose weight, but I hate exercising. I do want to get up, but it hurts. So we listen for change talk, things that would cue into us that the person has heard us. And what we're listening for in motivational interviewing is there a desire there? Does someone say something like, I wish I could lose weight? That would give you an idea, gee, they want to do this. And then do they get the sense they have the ability? Like, well, I could cut down on this or that, so that they have the desire and they have the ability to it. And then if they can reflect back to you, or you can encourage people to see the reasons, if I exercised, I'd have more energy. And they have a need for that. Like, it would be a good thing to have more energy. I need to get back, you know, to be more active. So maybe then they're ready to make a commitment. Like, well, I could get out and walk once a day. And they'll make that commitment with you. So we listen that the person has, despite the ambivalence, despite the but, that they've taken some steps toward change. Like, I borrowed a book, or I went the whole month without eating extra snacks. I walked up the stairs without taking the escalator. And these are the steps that shouldn't be missed, but are so important to be recognized and affirmed. And the MS nurses I know are great at this. I mean, I know it for myself, just any of us who go to annual meeting feel so energized and affirmed and just our, as Linda Morganti used to say, our wellspring of hope gets filled. So let's remember the acronym DARN, D-A-R-N, for desire, ability, reasons, and need. And those are the things that we can use to put it all together as we focus on building the skills that motivational interviewing would provide. Asking, we all do this with questions. You know, with the patients, we don't say, have you missed any of your doses? We'll ask, how many have you missed? So one is an example of closed and the other of opening questions. So we're questioning in either an open way, but we're more likely to elicit an accurate response. So we might say something like, perhaps you're relapsing. Do you miss your medications? Or how many do you miss? And then continuing with the idea of opened or closed questioning, we also listen. We listen for roadblocks. We listen, as the person just disagreeing you to get out of the door? You know, are we questioning? Are we warning? Are we coming across as the scolding parent? Are we sympathizing but not offering any suggestions? So we open the door to listening by extending an invitation and asking open-ended questions so that the person can really say what's on their mind and in their hearts. You can listen by reflecting. If the person says, I just hate needles. I mean, I take them most of the time, but there are nights I can't think of, just I can't bear the thought of taking it one more time. So you can reflect back. So you're feeling the reason you're having a relapse might be because you've missed some of your doses. Maybe that makes you feel a bit guilty. The person might be more willing to share with you.
Dottie, I hate to interrupt you. We have about 2 minutes left before we need to open the queue.
Okay, and I really do want us to have lots of time for questioning. So what I'd like to do is just really quickly go through the idea of informing, and then facing the reality that patients may not hear what you have to say. We can talk more about tips for effective informing as we go. And then if there's time later on, since we've already spent a great deal of time on motivational interviewing and communication, I did find some fun reasons of why not to trust your gut, because I think all of us who practice, we have a certain inner skill that may not be reflected in the stats. But please know that there are statistics on effective ways of using this as a tool for adherence and increasing the person's ability to communicate and use a technique like motivational interviewing. So with that, let me turn it back to Lori so she can open things up, and I'd like to hear what you have to say and get a discussion going.
Thank you, Dottie. That was excellent. Joe, would you like to go ahead and open the queue for the questions?